patch and get us a watermelon. We slipped in there one time, and our neighbor stepped out there with an old double-barrel shotgun. Boom, boom! Shot right over our heads in that watermelon patch, and he said, "Son," said, "y'all have all these watermelons you want, but just come by and tell me you're going in my patch, because I don't want my patch to work." I looked out my window the other morning, and two of my sisters was out there in my okra patch. Didn't even come by and tell me hello. They just got in their truck.
That was bad.
So when they get through, if anybody needs an okra, I got plenty. Y'all come on down in the patch. And we won't shoot at
you. And you won't call the law. I thought you were serious. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know it was Betty.
We've been looking at the book of Isaiah as well as Jeremiah. And we're bringing to a close both of those books. And it also, as we said on Wednesday night, brings a close to the divided kingdom. But we're in a section of Isaiah right now that really is an important section. And this particular section actually begins back in chapter 49. Isaiah chapter 49, and it goes all the way through chapter 57. And it talks about God's servant and His glory for Zion. And not only is it talking about the serious condition that Judah is in. You see, at this point, half of them were already in Babylonian captivity, and the other half waiting to go. But in spite of all of that, they were in a position to hear the prophets Isaiah as well as Jeremiah explain to them in prophetic language that in spite of the distress that they were going through, there was a bright future at the end. Now, Isaiah reminded them that a man by the name of Cyrus was going to be born that would become king, and he would lead them out of Babylonian captivity. But more so than that, he's telling them about the Messiah, about His virgin birth, about His death, burial, and resurrection, His ascension back to heaven, and the future glory of His kingdom, based on a covenant that He made with Abraham and David, that from their lineage one would come. The 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah, if you look at it alone and isolate the 53rd chapter, and then you say, "I'm going to do a study of that chapter," and you first do an expanded study of the context before you get to a serious study of the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, oh, you would have to go back and start back in chapter 51, 52, 53. And then you would have to get over into the New Testament. And you would have to look at everything the New Testament has to say about the virgin birth and the growth and the Lord's earthly ministry, His death, burial, resurrection, and ascension back into the heavens above. Really, when you stop and think about it, you're talking about having to read about the entire New Testament because it deals with the gospel, which is the message that we teach and preach and live by. So you can kind of see what an important section of Scripture this really is as you go through these studies. And you bring it to a close in chapter 57. For example, as we get our way, as we make our way through it quickly, chapter 49, verse 1. Listen, O Isle. Remember we said in this text, it's really talking about the Gentiles, those that were not God's chosen people, the Jews or the Gentiles. It's talking about the Gentiles. And he tells them, listen unto me, you people from afar. The Lord hath called me from the womb, from the bowels of my mother. Hath he made mention of my name? And he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. Then notice, if you will, you slip over into chapter 50. And again, he's talking about, in verse 1 of chapter 50, thus saith the Lord, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities have ye sold yourselves. Notice what it says. It wasn't God's fault, nor was it his son's fault, nor was it the Spirit's fault. It was Judah's problem, Israel, God's people. They had gotten themselves into the serious predicament. What was it? They were going into captivity. Oh, there was light at the end of the tunnel. Cyrus was going to allow them to go home. But we learn from Jeremiah as well as Isaiah that the cost of this was going to be the law of Moses. It was coming to an end. It was going to be wiped away and nullified. And a new covenant, oh, a much better covenant. A much better way that was going to include all nationality and races of people. They were going to be forgiven. And individually they would have the opportunity of being a part of New Jerusalem, that new city. Chapter 51, verse 1, hearken unto me, ye that follow after righteousness. What a breath of fresh air that really is. In spite of the idolatrous worship, in spite of everything that was happening in that day, a word of encouragement was coming to a remnant of people that follow after righteousness. Notice, if you will, he goes on in chapter 51 and he makes a statement. Look at Abraham, your father, and Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone. You know, so often we feel like that we're small. We're few in number. And there's really not much chance for us, so we have kind of an excuse for looking at faith. Don't you imagine these few felt the same way? Think about how that Daniel must have felt as a young lad. Ezekiel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Other faithful princesses and leaders of Israel that were still faithful, clinging to God. Think about how they must have felt. Isaiah said, remember Abraham. I called him. Not his whole family. I called him. And remember Sarah, your mother, that laughed. Laughed that loud when she heard that she and her and Abraham's old age were going to bear a son. Remember that family. Remember that little 75 that went down into Egypt when Joseph called him? And how that when they left under the leadership of Moses 400 years later, they were a mighty nation. I know that you're few in number. But if I can take one man, Abraham, and his wife, Sarah, and create a mighty nation, I can start this thing over again. And that's in reality. That is in reality what he's saying in chapter 53 when he says, "Look unto Abraham and unto Sarah that bear you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein. Thanksgiving and the voice of melody." Now what is he talking about? What does he mean? You see, he's saying, though you're looking at it in a way that you're disappointed, you're crying, you're hurt, you don't know how things are going to turn out, but let me tell you, there's going to be a time of singing. There's going to be a time of joy. There's going to be a time of happiness.
That voice of melody, could that be translated kind of like voice of praise, maybe?
Oh, no doubt that's what it's talking about. Now, it could have been when they were leaving Babylon, making their way back to Jerusalem. Or it could have reference to New Zion. The singing, the praise, the melody. Remember, Paul and Silas were where?
Prison.
And what were they doing?
Singing.
I told T.A., I got up this morning, singing the song that he's introduced us to, "Beautiful City of God." Didn't do too good with it, but I was still singing it. It was there. I couldn't help it. There's just a little tune about it. Some songs are like that. That's what he's saying here. There's going to be singing, joy. Verse 4 says, "Hearken unto me, my people, and give ear, my nation, for a law shall proceed from me." Now here is specific reference. Not to the old law, but to the new law. The law of Christ. The gospel that Jeremiah refers to as his covenant. Look what he says in verse 5. "My righteousness is near, my salvation is gone forth, and my arm shall judge the people." Look, if you will, in the book of Hebrews for just a second. 12th chapter. Hebrews chapter 12. And let's begin, if you will, down about verse 21. Hebrews 12 and at verse 21. "So terrible was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake." Here's a little word that we love so much. "But." Moses feared and quaked as they were giving him the law of Moses. "But you are come unto Mount Zion, unto the city of the living God." This may be where that song came from to you. That beautiful city of God, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an insurmountable company of angels. "To the general assembly and the church of the firstborn which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better things than that of Abel. Isn't that beautiful? That's what Isaiah is referring to here. My righteousness is near. My salvation has gone forward. Talking about the future birth, we talk about righteousness. How do we become righteous? Does our obedience to the gospel make us a righteous person?
It's a start in the right direction.
But where does it come from?
Jesus.
From Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross of Calvary. It's in Him that we can live a righteous life. We can't, by the deeds of ourselves, can we ever become a righteous person in the sense that Jesus was righteous. But He says here, righteousness is near. It is near because it was in God's manifold wisdom. When the time was right, He would allow His Son to leave heaven down the cross and be buried in that borrowed tomb, and He would raise Him from the dead. And He would rise up again to heaven. You see? It's near. Oh, it was much nearer than from the beginning. True enough. But it was still several hundred years away. But His righteousness is near. Salvation has gone forth. The plan went into order when? When Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. God wasn't set back. God wasn't confused. He didn't understand what to do and then sit down and make up a plan. It was already made. He knew that it would eventually require His Son to die on the cross. That's the reason Paul explained it to those Galatian brethren who were on the verge of walking out on God. When the fullness of time has come, God would send forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem them that was under the law. He had to remind them to wake up, people. Don't you know that's already taken place and you've benefited because of it? The last thing you need to do is leave the faith that you embrace. Now notice, if you will, lift up your eyes to the heavens, verse 6, and look upon the earth beneath. For the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, the earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner. There's that word again, but my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. My plan is going to go on eternally through my Son, who willingly died for you on the cross of Calvary. That's how righteousness becomes. We got people in the church, folks, that are teaching and have been teaching that you have to live a sinless life to be righteous. Well, I'm going to tell you what, if I got to do that, I'm in trouble, folks.
Boy, you know that's right.
But that is being taught. On the other extreme, we've got folks that says, we're not under any law. We're under grace. It doesn't make any difference how we live and what we do. You see the two extremes. Oh, how important David balance is. Balance in our Bible study. Balance in our teachings. Balance is so important. Righteousness is never going to stop because it's talking about His Son. And He is going to be eternal. 51, a beautiful, beautiful chapter. Notice, if you will, down at verse 8, 9. Awake, awake. Put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient days. Look at verse 11. The redeemed of the Lord shall return and come with singing unto Zion. And everlasting joy shall be on the head of they. Upon the head they shall obtain gladness and joy. Sorrow and mourning shall flee away. Now again, twofold. There's going to be singing and joy when they leave Babylon. There's no doubt about that. Anybody that would stand for days and listen to someone preach from a pulpit, they're thankful for their freedom, their joy. But all the real is yet to come. It's going to come through the virgin birth of our Savior. Notice, if you will, again in verse 17. There it is again. Awake, awake. Stand up, O Jerusalem. Why do you think He keeps saying that? Awake, awake. Don't you imagine that those that are dead spiritually, they need to wake up. They need to repent. Those that have remained spiritual have to be discouraged. They have to be at a low point. I mean, we're fixing to start looking at the book of Lamentations. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet. Can you imagine what Isaiah and Jeremiah and the prophets of old that were still living, what condition they were in spiritually? They had to be at an all-time low. How would you like to preach to a group of people like they? I can't imagine. So they too, they needed to wake up and know that this was God's plan.
Kind of like them old pep rallies we had in school. They're trying to pump and prime them, get them fired up again.
you might know you're going to get beat 50 to nothing.
Yeah.
You still had the pep rally.
That'll preach right there, boy.
But, you know, they needed a pep rally. And look here again, chapter 52. There it is again. Awake. Put on thy strength, O Zion. Put on thy beautiful garment. You get into 53, as we said. Oh, what a chapter it is. A person could spend months on end preaching from this chapter. And we're going to try to cover it today. Oh, we can't do it justice. But we can set the tone and the tenor to really appreciate and identify with the impact of the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. It is the lifeblood of our preaching, our teaching, our faith in the gospel. Then notice, if you will, in chapter 4, 54, "Sing, O barren, that thou didst not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, for thou that didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord." Now, as we said, things must have been in a desperate condition. But he's telling them, "Sing, O barren, and be faithful." What could the barren have to sing about and be faithful? Because how were the barren looked at? As unfruitful. But here they're told to do what? Sing. Why were they told to sing and be happy? What were they not going to have to see? What were they not going to have to witness as children?
Are going through the same thing.
Right. They are not going to have to see their children and their children's children go through what many are going to have to witness and have to see. Remember, we've been talking about Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. That was not the legitimate king, would have never been a king had it not been for Nebuchadnezzar, but he turns his back on Nebuchadnezzar. Broke covenant with him. Lost his 10 sons and his eyesight, and was led into Egypt. Into Babylon. So he's telling those that are barren, there's some hope in the future. Look at verse 2. "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thy habitation. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand, on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles." What in the world is he telling? What does he mean by "enlarge the borders of your tent"?
More people are going to be coming to the Lord. It's going to be open for the Gentiles, not just them. So you're going to have more people coming to the house.
Okay, good point. I'm not a tent maker, but I would imagine what he's trying to say is you need to sow and add to your tents. Because what you have is not sufficient. Now get this. He's referring to literal Jerusalem. Literal Jerusalem is not large enough. Judah and Israel as a whole, the land of Canaan, you've already had that. I gave it to you, Joshua said, every foot of it. Oh, it's gone. But I want you to know that though you lost it, it really wasn't large enough anyway. Because you see, in spiritual Zion, you've got to enlarge your tents. Because I'm going to build a spiritual city that your eyes cannot believe. This could have very well been the place where Brother Gus Nichols got the concept. Remember, he's the one that said, "Don't fall in love with the campgrounds." This is but a campground. And we're just camping.
That's it.
We don't need to fall in love with the campground. These Jews had fallen in love with Jerusalem. The premillennialists of our day, they fell in love with literal Jerusalem. And they want to recreate it anew, and God has already told us. That's not going to work. It's not going to work. It's not large enough. It's not big enough. My spiritual city has expanded walls and plenty of room for anybody that wants to come in, including the Gentiles. The Jews should have known that. And look how they treated the Samaritans. Look how they turned their backs on a Samaritan person when they met them eye to eye on the street. And yet, they should have known that the Samaritans were going to be just as welcome in this new spiritual city as was they. Said it right here, didn't it? Said it right here. Thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Fear not. Oh, you got to go into captivity. Got to spend 70 years. But you're going to be okay, the remnant that embraces Christianity. Now think about how that compiles with Ephesians chapter 3, and how Paul is impressing upon the minds of the Ephesian Christian, your Lord, your King, your Messiah, oh, He's King of Kings. He's Lord of Lords. He's the head of, the Savior of, the body, His body, the church, the kingdom, spiritual city, spiritual Zion. Peter would say in 1 Peter chapter 2 and at verse 11, back again to that comment that Brother Gus made many, many years ago. Peter said toward the end of his life, we are but strangers and pilgrims. Stay faithful. Don't get attached to this place. Paul made a statement in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and it left in verse 11. He says, you know, we're really hungry. We're destitute. We're beaten and whipped upon and cast into prison. But there's one good thing about it. He says, we do not have a special dwelling place. Now think about that.
Think about that.
And look what emphasis is placed today on things. Material things. Look at our toys. Look at our thing. Paul said, I didn't have a thing. I didn't even have a house. I went from place to place. And I counted it a joy because I know I've got a mansion. I've got a mansion waiting for me. Now notice, if you will, you follow on a little bit further. He said in verse 8, I'm going to kind of include 7 in this. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercy will I gather thee. In a little wrath, I hid my face from thee, and for a moment. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer. What do you think he's saying?
Jesus on the cross, maybe? Did he refer to Jesus on the cross?
Yeah, but I think he's putting more immediate emphasis on things leading up to the cross. And I think he's telling them, you know, he's trying to prepare the remnant to get ready for 70 years of captivity. He said, you know, I'm going to forsake you for a little while.
I turned my face and I've let you sit there and grieve for a little while. I let you have anguish for a little while. And for the long time, they were disobedient. He was disobedient to them just for a short while. Then he's going to bring them back.
He's going to bring them back. Now, you know what the Jews have not done? They do not accept Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God. They don't believe that he is. But do you know what they have not worshipped since those 70 years? You ever hear of a Jew bowing down to an idol? Nope. They worship the God of heaven. They'll not bow down to a God. The problem is they deny the God of heaven's Son, who became both God and man, to redeem them, to where David's point comes in. And God told him, I'm going to turn my face on you for a little while, but I'm going to let you go back, and then I'm going to allow my Son to come and die for you on the cross of Calvary.
They don't keep all the feasts and the sacrifices.
Oh, no. No, not at all. They sure don't. No. They absolutely do not. But the point I was making, they still believe in God, not an idol. And what they need to do is acknowledge the fact that the prophets let them know exactly what was coming, and that was the Messiah. And they rejected him.
Do they not? The Jewish people, do they not go have a Bible? Do they not go by Bible?
They know it better than me and you do.
Is that right?
The Old Testament. They don't believe in the New.
Okay, that.
But they know the Old like the back of their hand.
You think they keep all the feasts and the sacrifices?
But if they won't accept Christ, why would they? When you start down the road to error, you know, it never ceased to come along. And notice, look at verse 13 of chapter 54. Verse 12, I'm going to read it. And 13. I will make thy windows of adjutants, thy gates as carbuncles, and all thy borders of pleasant stones, and all thy children shall be taught of the Lord. And great shall be the peace of their children. But yet, what did they do with their Lord when he came?
Murdered.
They crucified him. And they should have known that all of their children would be taught of God. We'll stop here. Pick up in chapter 55 next week. Finish this section of 49 through 57. And then make an attempt to then wind down our studies of the book of Isaiah.